America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. If you have experienced something strange, if you've seen a cryptid, a ghost, a UFO, and you want to tell your story, you can email us, strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com. If you have a short encounter and you want to leave it as a voicemail, you can do that, 717-347-8554. That's definitely the quickest way to get us your story. At this point, I'm very backed up on interviews. You can call and leave a message. If you get cut off, you can just call back and continue your story. Again, that's 717-347-8554. Tonight, I'm going to be talking with Lex Nover about his book, Nightmareland: Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness. It is an excellent book, and I was happy to have Lex on. Covers things like sleep paralysis and parasomnias, sleepwalking, sleep deprivation, hypnagogia, alien abduction encounters, and more. But before I get to my conversation with Lex, I want to thank our patrons. Thank you so much, patrons. We could not do Strange Familiars without our patrons. If you'd like to help us make Strange Familiars and get extra content besides, you can become a patron at Patreon. That's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. There are many different levels of support there where you can get things like t-shirts, books, copies of my music CDs. There's even an original art level where you can get a piece of original art from me every month. You can check out all the levels of support at Patreon. Again, that's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. Even at $3 a month, though, you can get extra episodes of Strange Familiars. We do one full extra episode every month for our patrons. Often we do more. If you'd like to help us out and you do not like the idea of a monthly subscription like Patreon, you can always go to strangefamiliars.com and look in the show notes. There you will find a paypal.me link where you can make a one-time donation via PayPal. And a way everyone can help is to share the show on social media. Make sure to hit like and subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast. And leave us those nice 5-star reviews because that helps get the podcast in front of new potential listeners. So now let's talk to Lex Nover about Nightmareland. So I'm talking with Lex Nover, who has written a book, Nightmareland, and this book, is perfect for Strange Familiars listeners, and you're about to find out why. It deals with a lot of these sleep issues that we talk about so much on the show. And Lex has been the web producer for Coast to Coast AM since 2002. And if you're not familiar with Coast to Coast, they're sort of the flagship paranormal radio show that kind of got us all started, all of us paranormal podcasts and stuff. Lex, welcome to Strange Familiars.
Hey, Timothy. Thanks so much for having me on your show. Really appreciate it.
So is this your first book?
It is my first book.
What made you interested enough in this sleep phenomena to write a whole book on it?
Well, I was originally writing about kind of scary things that happen during the night. So it's sort of a natural tie-in to sleep phenomena. And I was looking very closely at sleep paralysis. And as I delved further into it, I started to see this relationship between strange phenomena and sleeping, dreaming, and states adjacent to that.
So you cover a variety of different sleep and dream-related topics, from sleep paralysis and hypnagogia, parasomnias, and sleepwalking. Out of all that stuff, what do you think was the most like shocking or surprising story that you found?
Well, there are several things that surprised me. There are a number of stories that have kind of shock elements to them. I have a chapter on sleepwalk murders and the idea that someone could kill in their sleep and not be consciously aware of it is something that's really strange and freaky to consider. But there were a number of surprises to me, like the hypnagogic state. I wasn't planning on spending that much time in the book. And then I discovered that it was really this fascinating gateway into psi phenomena and communications with the dead, as well as creativity. So that was a surprise to me. And the other thing I would have to say is this idea of non-REM sleep state. REM is the rapid eye movement state that we associate with dreams, these kind of narrative dreams. But what really surprised me is that during non-REM sleep or slow wave, deep sleep, we're actually dreaming then too. They're different types of dreams than the narrative ones in REM, but there's this content that's going on all the time. And for the most part, we don't remember it at all. So that raised certain questions and curiosities for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so fascinating. The book is, like I said, for Strange Familiars listeners, it's a must read, I have to say, because we cover so many of these topics. And before we jump in further, how many of these sleep-related phenomena have you yourself experienced?
Quite a number of them, and I get into some first-person accounts in the book. And one of the realizations in the research is that a lot of these are not that uncommon. It's just in the past and pre-internet, people didn't speak about them. And I think it's just been in recent decades with the growth of these sleep clinics across North America that people, these different conditions are coming out of the woodwork. And some of them are more playful and innocuous, and other ones are more serious and can even be dangerous. But I've had a couple of sleep paralysis episodes. I've experimented with hypnagogia as well as lucid dreaming. And so a little bit of a sampler pack, I guess you could say. What about you, Timothy?
I've definitely had sleep paralysis, and I've had my encounter with the little grays. Not super happy about them. The podcast listeners have heard it a million times, but it's a kind of sort of typical abduction experience I had. Not real pleasant. I'm not a fan of sleep paralysis myself. But in talking to people, so I've made it a habit of asking people. So, I'm talking to people every week. Most often it's witnesses. It's rare that I have an author or a researcher on. And one of the questions I ask them, though, no matter if they've seen Bigfoot or, had an encounter with grays or whatever it is, I ask people on the regular, have you in your life ever experienced sleep paralysis? And the number of people who have experienced paranormal phenomenon who also experience sleep paralysis is astounding. I very rarely get someone say, no, I've never had that. Now, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, do you think these things are connected? Some people are, you kind of use sleep paralysis as an explanation for paranormal events. I've kind of started to see it more as almost a symptom.
Well, I think there is an interesting tie-in, and I think I did run across some statistics that indicated that a lot of these different things are looped together. For instance, with sleep paralysis, out-of-body experiences and things of that nature are often accompanied in the experience. So some people actually have more positive experiences of sleep paralysis, where it's like a gateway for spiritual experiences and things of that nature. And I think with a lot of these different things, it seemed like there was kind of a psychic phenomena tie-in. I certainly found that with the research into bedroom alien abductions. People that experience that seem to have a whole host of phenomena. And then with things like psychic attacks, it seemed like there was a connection between poltergeists and hauntings and things related to those kind of disturbances.
When we talk about these things, we have encountered a lot of what John Keel termed these bedroom invaders that people see. And the big one for us on the show has been this flannel man that we call him. Other people call him plaid man, lumberjack man, etc., etc. My wife saw him. She woke up and saw him standing at our feet and scared her. She woke me up screaming. But she said he didn't look particularly menacing or anything. He looked surprised to see her. And I spoke about it once early on in the podcast, and all of a sudden I started getting a flood of stories from people. So I've seen this guy too. I've seen this guy too. Most often it's people wake up. It's not always hypnagogic, because sometimes people say that, you know, they literally get up and get a drink of water and then come back and see this guy. Did you run into any stories of that guy or anything like him?
I didn't particularly look at that kind of thing in terms of, I don't know if that would be classified as like a shadow person. We've had a lot of stories on Coast to Coast about the so-called Hat Man, mm-hmm. who is allegedly more of a sinister character. And then there's those sort of creepy pasta things like Slender Man, that it seems like there could be being birthed first from people's imagination, and then somehow, like tulpas, they actually have some kind of paraphysical presence, or that people sense them. What I ran across with the entities that people see during sleep paralysis, they seem to be more idiosyncratic. Like, people weren't seeing the same thing every time. It seemed like in each case it was something different. But this idea that you mentioned of the beings being startled that someone had just awakened and seen them, I ran across that, and that was really interesting to me, because it suggested this idea of almost like a hidden ecosystem. If these beings were feeding on our energy in some way, and they think that we're asleep or in that non-REM sleep state that I was mentioning, they could kind of come and go without our being aware of it. But instead of it necessarily being this parasitic or horrible thing, I wondered if maybe it was more like a symbiosis, that these entities, if they exist in this kind of paraphysical dimension, don't necessarily mean us harm. They're just kind of transiting in their own interactions that converge with us at times.
It's strange, because what I'm finding is different people from different cultures, you know, all over the world, are seeing the same things. So sometimes it's this flannel man guy. Sometimes it's, we've got another one we've just termed the nightmare creature, that people say it looks like kind of like the Green Goblin from Spider-Man. Very kind of sallow looking, stretched face kind of thing. And then, of course, shadow people, like you mentioned, in the Hat Man. And then these, and I think you do have this in your book, we've gotten some accounts of these like inky shadows. They're almost like squid-like things that people see. I mean, are we talking about some kind of other reality, you know, where there are these sort of dream characters exist outside of our reality, but are, in fact, you know, these same things that people are seeing when they enter the dream states?
Yeah, for me, it's really an open question. I don't weigh firmly down on one side or the other. In the book, I try to present the scientific or medical explanations behind a lot of these, but also give equal equal balance to the paranormal side and the idea that we could be in certain states or certain brain states, these kind of mixed states that I've come to think of almost like cocktails of consciousness, where we're mixing elements of being awake and asleep, that we might have access to these other realms and being able to have these kind of communications that are blocked out during our normal waking state.
By the way, I like that you kind of remain agnostic in that. And, you know, reading your chapter, and I realize you could have done probably a whole book just on alien abduction phenomena. And I use abduction in quotes because in my case, I don't think I ever left my bed. I think it was probably an out-of-body experience. But you kind of remain agnostic and you sort of present, you know, the different theories, the different sides of it. I like that because, I mean, in the end, who can know?
Yeah, and particularly with sleep paralysis, I mean, the neurological explanation, which has some, holds some water in the idea that, well, we're paralyzed and we're paralyzed during REM because we don't want to get up and start acting out our dreams. So that the idea that that carries over, but then the superimposition of these characters that, if the neurologist is saying, well, that's just a character from your dream that's kind of superimposed onto your waking state, I find that harder to jibe with the experience. It feels like it's something other than that. And certainly the beings that people see that are actually in their real bedrooms are quite palpable and real. It doesn't feel like some kind of hallucination or a dream character kind of blending in.
Yeah, exactly. Especially, like I said, when I get these accounts from these people just, you know, describing the same thing over and over again. These, you know, people just describing the same. It's usually not the same guy. He's usually dressed the same. But that nightmare creature is very specific that people are describing, you know, the same thing. You do have something in there about the black dogs. Now, we have noticed in some of these Flannelman accounts, also, he's accompanied sometimes by these black dogs, but that's a common saying, I guess, among truckers, is it?
Yeah, I included some details about that, and I did a chapter on sleep deprivation because a lot of strange stuff can happen when people go without sleep and become some of these blended states that we're talking about. The black dog actually dates back a millennium to lore from the UK, where sightings of them are often considered an omen of death, and sometimes they're described quite bizarrely as having glowing red eyes or as large as a house and really having these kind of phantom-like qualities. But the particular lore with truck drivers is that if you're driving along and you see a black dog on the side of the highway one time, it's like, okay, that's weird, there's a dog on the highway. But if you see the black dog a second time, then that's a warning that you're dead tired and you need to pull over and get some shut-eye before it's too late. But because you can imagine what would happen if a trucker falls asleep at the wheel. And sure, these types of instances are called microsleep, where someone is just so sleep deprived that the brain will just go into these little bursts of sleep up to 30 seconds at a time. So that would be a real living nightmare for a trucker to go into one of those states.
Yeah. Well, speaking of sleep deprivation, one of the most frightening things in your book that I found, I actually found this horrifying, like it was like horrifying to me, where the tales of the fatal familia insomnia, which is, I guess it's related to mad cow disease.
Yeah, that was a new one for me. I had not heard of this rare and somewhat bizarre syndrome. So when I ran across that, I I think there were a number of things that happened as writing the book, and having worked all these long years at Coast to Coast, I thought, well, I've heard every bizarre thing and under the sun. And I was like, okay, well, there's a new one among a number of things. But yeah, it started in a family in Venice, and they were thought to be kind of cursed over the years because it went back over 250 years. They were a wealthy family, but when people would get into their 50s, they would come down with this strange ailment, and basically they were unable to sleep and would just kind of fall into this strange netherland where they were neither awake or asleep, and then generally die within 6 to 12 months. And it wasn't until the 1980s that some research started to be done, and this whole connection, they were able to get a brain donated of one of the family members after he died. And that's when they found out it was this rare prion disease, like you mentioned, similar to mad cow. Prions are very bizarre in and of themselves. They're not alive, and yet they act like bacteria and start kind of propagating themselves when there's a genetic flaw. And so they were turning parts of the brain into these kind of Swiss cheese areas. And the part specifically was that regulated sleep. So it turns out that the people that had this rare ailment, they could never actually get that full sleep because that switch in the brain was deteriorated. So they're really stuck in this horrible limbo. And now there's work, promising research being done. So there's hope. It's a very rare disease. I think it's only like 30 or 40 families around the entire world that are afflicted with it.
Yeah, it just sounds horrifying. Yeah, prions they're a protein, and they replicate themselves. But yeah, for whatever reason, that one just shook me. I don't know if you saw it. It was an internet story going around that supposedly happened in Russia, and I don't know if it was ever true or not, but it had a horrifying picture of someone who looked very skeletal, and they said that they had kept him up for, I don't know how long. They just basically tormented these guys by keeping them awake. I don't know if you ran across that.
I did see that picture and was fascinated. I think it was later revealed to be a hoax, if I'm not mistaken, but I do kind of get into the use of sleep deprivation as torture in the book, which has a long and unfortunate history.
Yes.
Going back to like the Renaissance period, I think.
Well, and I'm not sure how, you know, much medically you got into this fatal familial insomnia, but I mean, do sleep pills help for them, sleeping pills, or it doesn't even work after a while?
There was one case that I looked at that was really intriguing. He's referred to in the literature as DF. And he was the son of a radio host, I think in the 50s or 60s, that was into nutrition and health. So he had kind of this unusual background. And he tried a whole battery of different techniques to try to actually get some sleep using all sorts of different drugs and concoctions, and did have some success. He was even had like a sleep deprivation tank for a while that he would get into and sleep for short periods. And it was a really interesting case because he actually talked about the state of being awake actually had some spiritual and positive dimensions for him. And though he eventually died, I think he ended up living longer than any other FFI patient. I think he was able to live for a number of years by trying all these techniques.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that just seems like a horrifying way to go for some reason. I don't know why that struck me so hard, but it did.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to say what the state of mind of the person going through it is. In some ways, maybe it isn't that torturous for them, but for the living and loved ones to see their close person or family member going through this, I think that would be incredibly scary and nightmarish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, some of your stories seem to suggest, like, almost in another reality, and we got into this a little bit talking about the characters people see during sleep paralysis, but it's maybe most dramatically demonstrated in your chapter in Lucid Dreaming. And the story I'm thinking about in particular is the woman who put the man who dreamed about the woman who put the cigarette out on his hand.
Yeah, that was a really sort of funny, but I'm sure terrifying experience for the dreamer. What happened was, this is his self-report about this to a dream researcher, but he was at this swanky party in this penthouse overlooking the city, and there was jazz music playing, and a beautiful woman was sitting on his lap. And then he realized right in the middle of that, like, oh, this is actually a dream, and I'm laying asleep in a bed in a cheap rented room in Chicago. And somehow he knew that his alarm was about to go off. So he has this realization, and that's when he became lucid in the dream. And the woman asks him, like, oh, are you having a good time? And he was like, yeah, I'm having a great time, but my alarm's about to go off, and all this will be over. And she was like, well, what are you talking about? What do you mean? And he's like, this is just a dream. I'm laying in bed, actually. And she got really annoyed and offended. And she was like, I'll show you whether this is a dream or not. And she took her lit cigarette and put it out on his right hand. And then he instantly woke up and claims that there was a burn in his hand and even cigarette ashes there when he woke up in physical reality. So it's an interesting question as to whether maybe he was a smoker and had left, fallen asleep with a cigarette, or if there was some kind of bleed through effect. But certainly I think it demonstrates the idea of certain dream characters can be quite independent, and it makes a person wonder whether some dream characters are not people we're just conjuring up, but have their own independent reality.
Right. There's even a story in there that, you know, it sort of hints at the idea maybe of someone possibly encountering other lucid dreamers in their dream. I'm thinking about the one where the guy said they seem to be waiting for him to become lucid.
Yeah, I believe that was Robert Wagner, who's kind of a lucid dreaming extraordinaire, has a few books out about it. And his personal experiences are really kind of mind-boggling to consider. He's done quite a bit of research on this whole idea of dream characters and even this reality kind of behind the dream, where he talks to the dream itself. But that particular instance that you were mentioning, I thought was kind of powerful. This idea that these people that he was hanging out with had like a complete change of awareness when he became lucid. They all like cheered and were like, hey, we were waiting for you. And it really struck me that in our normal dream state, we are in a way kind of sluggish or sort of semi-drunk. Like we're just not a completely aware person that we could be.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
So you go into lucid dreaming a bit, and this is not, to my knowledge. Now, I was on a show, Nox Mente, where people talk about their dreams, which, by the way, I don't know if you've been on that show, but you might look into that. It'd be an excellent show for you to talk about this book. But they said, when I was describing my dreams, they said, well, you might be going lucid and not knowing it, which to me is kind of, I don't know, I don't understand that, because lucid being the key term there, I would think I would know it. But in any case, to my knowledge, I don't go lucid dream. But you sort of go over a little bit about the way that people become lucid. They look for sort of triggers. You start practicing, I guess, during the day while you're awake. Just look for these different triggers to go into these lucid states.
Right. There's reality checks where you look at different things and see if they change. For me, I use the text one. So, for instance, I try to do it when I'm out riding my bike, and I'll look over at like an address or signage and then see what the number or the word is, and then turn my head away and then look back. And if it stays the same, that's verification that you're in waking reality. But if it changes, that's an indicator that you're actually in a dream. The problem is that even if you practice this kind of reality checks during your waking hours, it rarely translates over to the dream state. Mm-hmm. So I've tried a variety of things to induce lucidity, and I think some people have a natural ability at it, and other people have to work a lot harder to create the environment for it. Now, as far as what you were saying about different kinds of lucidity, that's something that I've experienced and also run across in the research, that there are semi-lucid states, almost like a continuum, really. An example of that might be where I had a dream when I was writing the book about a friend who had recently died, and I think I had taken some galantamine, which is a supplement that kind of wakes up some of your neurotransmitters and is said to increase the chances for lucidity. In this case, I didn't recognize that I was in a dream, but I did recognize that my friend was dead. So that, I thought, was a kind of on the continuum of lucidity, because typically if you see a deceased person in a dream, you're just like, wow, it's great to see you. And you might not realize that they were dead. And so this opened up kind of an interesting window. So I was able to kind of ask him a little bit about the afterlife. And he was saying some things that I could check later to see if he might have some kind of omniscient point of view into our world. So that was a very memorable, I guess you could call it, semi-lucid state.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Did you learn anything from him?
Well, one of the things I checked out didn't prove to be true, that he had said that the people that had bought his house were not living there yet because they were doing some major renovations. And I was able to check up on that and found out that that wasn't the case. Huh. So it made me wonder. I thought, well, this really did seem like my friend. And so, again, it's one of those open questions. Was that really his spirit visiting me? And is he, the information he was giving me might be true in whatever reality he's accessing. So it didn't, because the information didn't correlate in our world, didn't necessarily mean that that wasn't his spirit per se.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I've had people tell me with absolute confidence that, you know, if you dream of a loved one, a past loved one, it means they're passing on. And I often think, how do you know? Mm-hmm. Where's the rule book for this? It's I'm just like, show your work, because I don't know about that one, because I've dreamed my father passed last year, and I've had several dreams about him. At which dream did he pass on then, if I've had multiple dreams?
You mean by pass on, sort of move to a further layer?
Yeah. So I guess the idea is that that I've been told, you know, again, that if you dream about a deceased family member, that means they've kind of passed on to heaven or to the other realm or you know, whatever label you want to call it. But like I said, what happens if you've had several dreams of this person, at which point, you know, did they pass on the first one, or the others just dreams, or you know, what's the rule book with that?
Yeah, years ago I had a dream about my mom who had passed, and we were on an airplane, and I think at some point I realized that she had died, and was very, very sad to experience that in the dream. And then she went and sat, after talking with me, she went and sat in her seat and then changed into someone else. So I thought, well, maybe the obvious dream interpretation there is that, like, a reincarnation kind of idea, or that she's moving on, whether that was my subconscious trying to create that impression for me, or if it was some kind of visitation from her, who knows?
Right, yeah. I didn't know if you ran into any sort of old folklore that talks about that aspect of dreaming, you know, dreaming about dead relatives or anything like that.
Well, I did find a number of things related to the hypnagogic state that surprised me in terms of relating to this whole visitation. You probably have heard of what's called crisis apparitions, which is when people get like a spiritual visitation and from, say, like their grandmother, and then they find out that right at the moment she was visiting them seems to correlate with when they died in the hospital or wherever. Mm-hmm. And what surprised me about this was it seemed like a lot of these experiences, maybe most, occur adjacent to sleep or just as someone's waking up. So kind of in this hypnagogic umbrella that either just before falling asleep or just after waking up. I talk about in my experience with my father in my book that where he and I have this conversation just after I woke up, and I just thought, oh, this is just some weird flukish thing, and wondering about how that happened and all of that. And then I realized that, okay, that actually could be classified as this form of hypnagogia, which, again, to sort of go back to what I was saying before, that these types of communication seem to occur more readily in the states that are mixed, that are combining elements of sleep and wakefulness, which I guess is what happens when we're first waking up from sleep.
Right. And just for a little side note, you kind of use hypnagogia as the general umbrella for the hypnopompic state and the hypnagogic state.
I do, because one of the big researchers on this named Andreas Mavromatis wrote kind of like the Bible, I guess you could say, of hypnagogia. And he was the one that paired them together with that term, even though hypnagogia generally had referred to just the state before you fall asleep. But it seemed like that the two states were so similar that I just thought I'd follow his path to include them both together under the same term.
Yeah. Yeah. So having been around, you know, coast to coast AM for so many years, I'm sure you've run into any number of these alien abduction stories. When you went to write about that for the book, and again, like I said, I realize you could have probably devoted a whole book just to that, but you know, you got to cover all aspects of the sleep phenomenon. Did you find out anything that was surprising or new to you, or a different sort of take on the abduction phenomenon that you didn't have going into it?
Well, I wanted to write about the phenomenon because back in the 90s, there were a couple of psychologists that created kind of a publicity storm, or basically stating in a kind of case closed way that bedroom alien abductions were nothing more than misidentified cases of sleep paralysis. So because of that, I thought that was a good tie-in to where I was going with the book. And I've long been fascinated by the whole lore and stories of aliens. It has certainly been a mainstay of Coast to Coast. I think that there are certain similarities in that a lot of abductees report being paralyzed. But to me, the idea that there is a UFO kind of parked in their backyard or hovering nearby, that didn't really seem to make sense. So I thought, well, perhaps some of these are actually cases of sleep paralysis. It's hard to know exactly, but it seems like it's a different pattern, kind of like what you were saying before about Plaid Man, that people are describing the same thing over and over again, these kind of repetitive examinations aboard UFOs or maybe seeing hybrid babies. And that to me didn't really fit in with the idiosyncratic and personal nature of sleep paralysis. So I think I started wondering if this alien thing had a certain similarity to what people experience in sleep paralysis, but was actually maybe a modality that these sort of paraphysical entities were using to have these communications with people. And the idea that the storyline, I guess, that's presented to the abductees, to me, doesn't really make that much sense in terms of, you know, these kind of bad science fiction ideas like, well, we came from a planet where we're, you know, a dying planet and we need to replenish, and just right. Some of the barbaric things that they do to abductees. I'm not sure what your experience was, but it all seems very crude. So that made me wonder if it's some kind of theatrical production almost, as some kind of psychological experiments, or if it's this idea of this feeding of energy, maybe that fear and certain emotions are like a food or energy source to, I guess you could call them astral entities or beings that exist in some other dimensional framework that occasionally intersects with ours. And maybe we're open to these intersections when we have these kind of mixed brain states.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure if this is a direct quote, but I believe you know, someone you mentioned in the book talks about it being almost like a shared out-of-body experience, which the more I kind of think about it, the more I learn about this stuff, that seems to be closer to what's would happen with me, I think, than anything else. In other words, I often say, I don't think I ever left my bed. I don't think I was put on a UFO. You know, I don't think there were little scientists from another planet next to me. It's a very real feeling. It was very, very much real. It wasn't dreamlike. And in fact, I've described it as realer than real life, in a sense. It was absolutely real, but it was the physics didn't make sense as far as our physics in this world. And the way they communicated did not make sense either. I didn't get mind speak, but I got communicated with. I got notions, I guess.
Was there some sort of storyline or narrative they were conveying to you?
No, not so much. I was very much in protest. It was sort of a mental wave of a hand, just like this doesn't matter. You don't matter. Like your protest doesn't matter. At once, in one of these instances, they did speak, two of them in unison. It's absolutely, you know, speaking with the same voice in unison, very, very, very strange. But, you know, it seems more like, you know, an out-of-body experience. And, you know, you've related, of course, to the fae phenomenon and, you know, in the past, the folklore and some of these, you know, incubus and succubus kind of accounts and from the past and so forth. And I think there's, you know, just my gut feeling says it's more akin to that than little scientists from another planet.
Yeah, I guess it's a sort of a Jacques Vallée idea that these entities kind of drape themselves in different ways over different time periods, but it's not necessarily new beings that are like, okay, now the space age aliens are here.
Right.
There was an interesting case I thought that I would mention just in relation to this discussion. There's an avid lucid dreamer named Ed Kellogg who has published a number of really interesting papers online. And in one of them, he writes about a lucid dream that was a kind of alien abduction. So I thought that was a really interesting mix, where the idea that someone could be lucid and aware that they're dreaming and then have this kind of creepy encounter with these beings who are actually sort of goading him into these brain experiments.
Yeah, that's very, very strange.
I guess it kind of shows that lucid dreaming isn't necessarily about the dreamer having, I think a lot of people think of it like, oh, it's just this big playground and I'll just have all these fun scenarios that I'll just, you know, kind of like Samantha and Bewitched. But actually there does seem to be this independent reality, even in your own lucid dreams, that, you know, you could even have a nightmare in that state.
Yeah. There was, the one you mentioned, would seem quite horrible, where the guy seemed to be trapped sort of in a dream cycle where he could not get himself out of the lucid dream.
Yeah, that's what's called false awakening. I've had a few of those, not necessarily associated with lucid dreams, over my lifetime. And it is kind of a really freaky thing. But what happens is you wake up from the dream, you get up out of your bed, you go and you start your day. And then all of a sudden something strange and weird and impossible even happens. And then that's when you realize, oh, I'm still dreaming. The incident I describe in the book was Robert Wagner again, who had 7 false awakenings in a row. And at that point, it was almost like a little bit of a mini mental breakdown where you're just like, where is reality?
Right. Yeah, he talks about all, like, I at some point in all that, he said, well, if I can't, whatever reality I end up in next is where I'm staying.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. That's kind of horrifying. So how much has like modern medicine with drugs like Ambien, how much has that impacted these parasomnias and these related issues?
I think Ambien is implicated in quite a few of the different parasomnias, as well as some of the benzodiazepines and different things that kind of give people these states where unusual things can happen, whether they're waking up unexpectedly. Funnily enough, though, one of the treatments for a lot of the parasomnias, like sleepwalking, is a low dosage of clonopin, which is kind of a sedative. And the idea there is that people that sleepwalk or sleep eat have kind of a low arousal threshold. And that means that they're more prone to having these partial awakenings. Maybe a sound or a nudge or something will awaken them, but just in this weird half state where they're get up and start sleepwalking. So something like clonopin acting as a sedative reduces that threshold, so they're able to sleep more soundly. But yeah, I get into some of the really bizarre things that have happened on Ambien. I think I referred to it as the Ambien zombies, where people wake up in jail cells and things like that. A lot of that, I think, happened in the earlier years of Ambien usage before the drug manufacturer made a bigger deal out of the warnings, which one of the main ones is not to combine alcohol on it.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's some pretty wild, like, sleepwalking stuff in there. There's you have a couple sleepwalk murders, which you touched on a little bit before. Now, these people, one of them got off, was found innocent.
Yeah, I think a number of the people have, but are you referring to the Kenneth Parks case in Canada?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most infamous of all of the cases. But he, in 1987, he ended up driving a car 14 miles to his in-laws' home and then viciously stabbing them. One of them died and one of them survived. And after the incident happened, he took himself to the police station early in the morning and said, I think I've killed my in-laws. But what was bizarre was that all 10 tendons on his hands had been completely cut through, I guess, from the kitchen knife kind of slicing into his hands when he was using it. And but it appeared that he felt no pain, so it was kind of like, I think they called it like a sort of retrograde analgesia effect. But that was used in the trial as a piece of evidence, along with he was able to show quite a bit of history in terms of having different sleep problems. There's a machine called a polysomnogram that's able to indicate different sleep abnormalities. And he had a whole family history of sleepwalkers. And so he actually got off scot-free. And then the prosecution sought to appeal the case and went all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court, who upheld the original decision. But it certainly puts into question the whole idea of what do we consider voluntary and involuntary, And then when are people malingering or sort of making this up as kind of a Twinkie defense? I think in his case, is a good argument that he was in some kind of fugue or sleepwalking state. And yet it's such a heinous crime, it seems kind of shocking for someone just to walk away without any penalty from that.
Yeah, and his wasn't the only sleepwalk murder that you covered in the book, and others weren't so lucky in their defense. They got convicted.
Right. It really varies from case to case, and I think in more recent ones, like the Scott Fallader case in Phoenix, it ended up being a battle of the sleep experts, kind of like you see with a lot of murder cases where you pit the different forensic experts against each other.
Right, yeah. Well, there's all these different bizarre, like, sleep activities that people were doing, and was it, there was some celebrity, was it Montel Williams you had in there who wouldn't have raw meat in his house?
Yeah, that was in my section on sleep eating. He would wake up in the morning and find bite marks in even in like frozen meats, and so
wow.
He just like I can't keep this in the house anymore. But that sleep eating is actually not that uncommon. I think like 1% of the population experiences that, and like a lot of these parasomnias, there's a certain amount of shame and secretiveness about this. It's just in recent years with these sleep clinics I was mentioning that people are seeking to get help, because I think it's just a strange feeling that when people are doing these things that they're not conscious of, it really is very unnerving, and people don't want to talk about it in a sense.
Yeah. I can imagine. Where there's some of the cases you talk about, people, you know, having sex during sleep, basically, and not realizing it, and some of their partners being very happy with it, and others not so much.
Yeah, it really runs the gamut. There was one case that was kind of amusing where the woman was reporting on her partner, and she wasn't really sure if he was asleep or not, but she was enjoying their their conjugal relations, and then at one point, while they were in the midst of it, he actually started snoring. So that was sort of the dead giveaway.
Oh, boy.
But sexsomnia, as it's called, that wasn't officially classified as a sleep disorder until 2014. So it really shows you how new a lot of these classifications are, even though the behavior is probably, you know, as ancient as a lot of these.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure it goes back just as long as the rest of them. So doing the research and writing this book, has it changed the way you yourself approach either sleeping or, you know, think about dreams in general?
I think it has. I think it feels like, in spite of the myriad scary accounts featured in the book, I also feel like it's really given me the sense of this kind of exciting portal, whether it's through lucid dreaming and trying to perfect and enhance that, or something like hypnagogia, which really is accessible to everyone. And that really struck me as an interesting modality that people can attempt to glean creative ideas or different forms of communication from.
Yeah. Was it in that chapter where the guy was talking about doing math problems in the dream state?
I think there was one instance of that, like in the chapter I have about nightmares.
Okay. Where, all right.
It was kind of a humorous from the reader perspective, I think, because the idea that numbers would be the subject of nightmares it seems sort of absurd, but in his case, it was just this, like the picturing of these numbers and these equations that were just becoming like these massive weights of, there was a kind of like a horrific aspect to it.
I can't think of anything I'd rather be doing than math problems in my dream. Well, Lex, thanks so much for coming on Strange Familiars. Do you know what's next for you? You working on anything else?
Not at the moment. I'm just kind of doing the publicity ride for the book. I have some ideas about another book, but I guess I'm going to ride this wave and see where it goes. I've really enjoyed chatting with you, Timothy. In a way, I feel like I've really come home to be on your show, which feels like very welcoming to talk with someone who's so fluent in these topics.
Well, thank you for coming on. Again, the book's Nightmare Land, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness by Lex Nover. It's on Amazon and I guess wherever else you can buy books, right?
Yeah, I have a website, nightmare.land. And there's also a really cool audio book read by Neil Heligers, which is kind of a fun experience in its own right.
Oh, that's a great idea. That's a great idea to have an audio book of it. Very good. Well, everybody should check it out. Nightmare Land, like I said, it's probably a perfect book for Strange Familiars listeners. Lex, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Before we go, I want to note that there will be a new version of my Wildnisgeist CD. There is a reason for this. Wildnisgeist is a part of an upcoming production. I'll be able to announce more soon. But in celebration of this, I am doing a special edition, which comes in a hand-stenciled bag with a special gifting coin, an extra CD, a little hex book, and a piece of quartz from Hex Hollow. So this new special edition will be out soon, next week, if you're interested in my music. And Wildnisgeist is kind of like the more dark ambient music I use as sound beds for Strange Familiars. So if you enjoy that, you will hopefully enjoy Wildnisgeist and pick up the special edition with all of the limited bonus items. I will mention it again, but it will be on Bandcamp, stonebreath.bandcamp.com. Links are always in the show notes. We will be back soon with another episode of Strange Familiars. And remember, you can always find us at strangefamiliars.com. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, music, books, art, podcasts, and more. DarkHollerArts.com. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. Go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com for more. We are on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars, where you can also find the Strange Familiars Gathering Group, and we are on Instagram @strangefamiliars.
Hi, my name's Taylor. This is a pretty short story, but we talked about it on the Discord a little and figured I'd share it for the podcast. A few weeks ago, I had a dream. It was kind of near the tail end of the dreams where I was at a friend's house on a couch, laying on the couch, and it was late at night, and everyone was sort of going to bed. And I looked up because I saw a light shining through a window, and I kind of, you know, it took me a second to focus on it, but it was a man in a large bunny costume, like a pink bunny costume, shining an industrial flashlight through the window at me. And I got up and started moving towards him, and he kind of backed off. And I was like, all right, that's weird. So I tried to go back to bed, and all of a sudden he was there again, shining this light. And then I woke up after that and was like, wow, that's bizarre. All right, well, thanks. See ya.
Catch the feather, dust the bone. Sound the chant that will call the ghost. Through the smoke, red eyes shine. In the astral secret sign. Just beyond the reach of light. Heavy wings beat in the night. Hear the call, hear the shriek, hear the strange winged creatures speak. Call the lightning, call the storm, call the undead and the unborn. In the thunder and the rain, unseen spirits speak your name. Face the hate, face the white, face the things hidden by the night. Hear the whistle, hear the coo, hear the words they speak to you. Scratch the feather, dust the bones, sound the chant that will call the ghost. Hail the other and the unknown, hail to spirit made flesh and bone.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.